Welcome to the Florida Roundup here on Florida Public Radio. Thanks for listening this week and supporting public media. I'm Tom Hudson in Miami.
And I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville. Well, it has been a tough week for Florida Governor Ron DeSantis. The governor was heckled again this week as criticism mounts of his management of the coronavirus pandemic. Cases of coronavirus are soaring in the state, but DeSantis maintains his administration is following the correct path in fighting the virus.
This week, the governor also distanced himself from a controversial edict from Education Commissioner Richard Corcoran that Florida schools be open 5 days a week in brick-and-mortar buildings beginning in August. Teachers are suing the governor over that order.
Now, the missteps are having an impact on the governor's popularity. A new Quinnipiac poll of Florida has DeSantis seeing the lowest ratings of his time in office to date at just 41% approval. That is an enormous drop in public confidence since April.
And then last night, President Donald Trump pulled the plug on the Republican National Convention coming to Jacksonville. That move came after officials in Jacksonville said the event could not be secured or paid for without more oversight and a better plan for health and safety. So how about the political handling of the coronavirus here in Florida? 305-995-1800. What about the RNC pulling out of Jacksonville? Your thoughts, 305-995-1800 or on Twitter at Florida Roundup.
WJCT's Sky LeBron has been covering the cancellation of the RNC in Jacksonville and joins us now. You know, Sky, right up until the president's announcement last night, the RNC host committee here in Jacksonville, where you and I sit, well, they said the event was full steam ahead. But we got a warning earlier in the week things might be amiss. Jacksonville Sheriff Mike Williams came out Monday and said, look, I can't secure this event. How much do you think the sheriff's move might have factored into the president's decision?
I think a lot. We saw it in the national media as well. You could have looked at any national outlet and Sheriff Mike Williams was right there and giving his statement. I think it had a lot to do with the overall cancellation when he's saying, look, the plan that we're seeing, we're at a point of no return. That's him verbatim saying that there is no feasible way that he sees this convention being held safely with the rising number of coronavirus cases, along with just social distancing measures and a lot of the different things that they were trying to implement in just 2 months.
We're hearing nothing was spent locally to host the RNC here other than man hours city employees put into the event. You know, Jacksonville Mayor Lenny Curry so far is dodging local reporters to comment on this news. He had lobbied to get the convention after Charlotte, North Carolina, said it couldn't happen there without masks and social distancing. Governor DeSantis, too, pushed hard to bring the convention to Florida. How does this play with those two politicians now that we're not going to see this event?
Well, I think for Governor DeSantis, he tried to distance himself recently from it. He said last week when he was in Jacksonville, you know, I'm hands off. When it comes to Mayor Lenny Curry, it doesn't look too good for him right now. Even when Sheriff Mike Williams said what he had to say regarding, you know, I don't think that this really should be happening here, Mayor Curry came the next day and said, I still think that this can happen safely. And with that, he was saying he agreed with the sheriff that things aren't going to be safe right now, but he still kept on pushing the train forward of, we're still going to be doing this, we're still going to be doing this. And it also brings into question, how much did he know and how far ahead of time did he know that this was not going to be happening in Jacksonville?
The majority of voters in Jacksonville and Florida were opposed to this convention. Certainly public health experts were warning it would be a super spreader of COVID-19. What are you hearing from average citizens about this?
Well, when you look on social media, you see a ton of people breathing a sigh of relief. Now, with that, there were people that I spoke to that were excited for the RNC. A lot of business owners saw it as an economic opportunity. There were a lot of vendors, over 1,000, that signed up. So I imagine that they're disappointed. But for the average citizen, I mean, polls already showed that this was not a popular thing in Jacksonville. I was just at a protest earlier today where they were talking about a plethora of issues, but all of them were so excited to know that their activism and their pushing was successful in not bringing the convention here.
WJCT's Sky LeBron, thank you.
You're welcome, Melissa.
Let's take a quick phone call from Key West. Chuck is calling in 305-995-1800. Hey, Chuck, your thoughts?
Yeah, I'm just commenting that I'm scared about that RNC meeting up in North Florida that was supposed to be. I'm glad they've canceled it, but I can't believe that they're going to cancel that and then push for schools to be open, which will be a convention of kids for weeks and months. I think that's going to be an even greater virus spread. Thank you so much for allowing me to call.
Chuck, I appreciate that. I'll have you hold on, listening at least. We're going to drill down into schools coming up in just a few moments here on the Florida Roundup, and would love to hear more thoughts about the schools reopening, when and how in your neighborhood. 305-995-1800. Matt Dixon joins us now via FaceTime audio, reporter with Politico Florida. So, Matt, how does the president pulling the plug on the RNC in Jacksonville reflect upon Governor DeSantis?
Well, you sort of at the beginning of the segment ticked off Ron DeSantis's, Governor DeSantis's week, and oh boy, it's sort of the hits keep coming, and the most recent one obviously was yesterday when President Trump used his briefing and sort of, you know, national spotlight to pull the RNC. I totally agree that it's difficult for the mayor, obviously, but even though Governor DeSantis has kind of been hands-off and he has really, when asked about it, taken that approach, his entire sort of political brand and sort of DNA is tied to President Trump. Yeah. They're supposed to be allies and work together. So I think without question, this is a blow to the governor. He wasn't in the weeds handling it, but it's not good for him.
Not in the weeds, but do you think there was a heads up call from the Oval Office to the governor's mansion to say, hey, the president's going to say this from the podium in the media center today?
I have no reporting to indicate one way or the other personally, but just the way that the White House kind of moves pretty quickly. So I think in sort of a normal political ecosystem, you could very much expect that. You would give a governor who's an ally a heads up about big news coming down the pipeline. I don't know if that's exactly how this White House operates, so I'm not sure if there was a heads up or not. I think ordinarily under a status quo situation there would be, but I think we're not exactly. We've long passed status quo at this point.
This week, President Trump was back in the press center in the White House, and he took a bit of a different tact making this admission.
It will probably, unfortunately, get worse before it gets better. Something I don't like saying about things, but that's the way it is.
The president then singled out Florida during the press conference on Tuesday.
We have big fires, and unfortunately now Florida is in a little tough or in a big tough position. You have a great governor there. You have a great governor in Texas. You have people that are very, very skilled people, and I think they're going to handle it very well.
So Matt Dixon with Politico, how does this from the president resonate here with the governor's office?
Oh, I think those comments in particular were key for a few reasons. First, it's the first time the president or the White House has singled out Florida in a negative light. They've sent administration officials here. They have talked about Florida from the briefing room, but it's always been through a lens of positivity. Even as the numbers spiked, they've always had a talking point or a data point to put the best face forward. That's now kind of over. The White House is talking in more blunt terms starting this week. And second, I think it's important because there's now obviously some messaging distance between the White House and the governor's office. DeSantis still, and administration officials, still try to hold on to sort of a positive message. When you see the governor do his coronavirus briefings, which he does do a lot, he's accessible. There isn't talk of deteriorating numbers, a stressed healthcare infrastructure, double-digit positivity rates. Right. There's always a line or a point that they can point to say, hey, it's getting better, we're doing this right. So with the White House saying one thing and the governor's office saying another, that's kind of the first time there's been separation between the two, and I think that's notable.
Yeah, and this daylight is notable, right? Because even the White House leveled criticism generally about states reopening too early, didn't single out Florida in that criticism, but it was clear it was directed at Florida and other states when a White House official mentioned bars, for instance, opening too early. And then this week in a phone call with Trump administration officials and state and local leaders, The head of the White House Coronavirus Task Force, Dr. Deborah Brix, warned that 11 major cities, including Miami, she named it by name, should take more aggressive actions, noting that each day waiting is a day lost.
When you first see that increased test positivity, that is when to start the mitigation efforts. If you wait another 3 or 4, even 5 days, you'll start to see a dramatic increase in cases.
Audio of that phone call, Matt, was obtained by the Center for Public Integrity, and it comes as the governor is scheduled to be in the White House today on this Friday for a White House event at 3 p.m., I think, and then a meeting with the White House Chief of Staff a little bit later on. Any idea what that topic is going to be, and should we be on point to kind of hear perhaps a shift in tone from DeSantis after this White House meeting?
I don't know what the Chief of Staff meeting is. I believe he's going to be there. At least the timing coincides at 3 p.m. He's supposed to be there. The president's going to sign an executive order on health care. I think that's the public-facing event that the reason the governor's going to be in the White House. I can't speak to what the Chief of Staff meeting is going to be, but just on the audio that you just played from Dr. Birx there, I think it is notable the sort of the candor and the blunt nature at which she spoke, you know, for non-public comments. That's not how she sounds when she's doing a press conference or a briefing. And I think it's interesting that there's, you know, 11 major cities that have a real issue. I don't know why you wouldn't want to communicate those real issues to the, you know, the officials and the you know, the people who live in those cities rather than, you know, speaking one way when things are not public versus how you speak in a briefing. So I think the way that audio sort of signifies the different messaging based on the audience, which I think should be watched.
It's 305-995-1800 to join the Florida Roundup as we talk about the way the governor is handling the pandemic here. The RNC pulling out of Jacksonville due to the coronavirus spread around the state. Matt, a new poll from Quinnipiac University in Florida shows Ron DeSantis has plummeted in terms of public confidence in this state. He's at about 40% approval among Florida voters. That's his lowest rating since he was elected. He was heckled twice this week by protesters who have been hounding him about his handling of getting coronavirus positive testing rates down. Do you think these terrible numbers for the governor will force him to change strategy or change policy in any way in terms of how he is approaching pandemic response in the state?
It will be interesting to see, because so far the governor, in the face of a lot of criticism, has sort of been defiant almost as far as changing tune, changing path, changing messaging. So if he does in the pandemic, it would probably be the first time. So the next maybe week or so, I would say, for your audience to kind of, for those who like to watch the governor, watch to see if Governor DeSantis looks different going forward. Because you're right, I wouldn't be doing my job as a Florida political reporter if I didn't mention Quinnipiac sort of has a bad track record here. They're not necessarily the most accurate, but what is very clear.
So take those numbers with a grain of salt then, in other words. Big dive in his numbers.
That's correct. I was just going to say the trend line is very clear. This is impacting the governor's once stellar approval ratings. So I don't know if it's going to signal a shift or not, but I think the next few days will be very telling. And that's definitely something to keep an eye on.
Certainly the last week, right, has been very telling in continuing to strike this optimistic tone, as you mentioned earlier, Matt, when the governor's talking about the coronavirus and arguably dismissing some of the trend lines that have been in place really for the better part of a month in some communities. And then there was this moment, right? On Saturday, the governor held a press conference in St. Augustine to talk about COVID-19. He was asked about the death of civil rights icon Congressman John Lewis, someone who DeSantis served with on Capitol Hill.
All right, yeah, I appreciate the question, but we're trying to focus on a coronavirus, so I appreciate it, but I'm gonna let someone ask about you. Do you have a question about the topic at hand?
So, Matt, has the governor made a public comment about the passing of Congressman Lewis?
Yeah, he tweeted later that evening, but I can say that advisors and even Republicans were a little frustrated by that comment. A whole bunch of Republicans put out but glowing statements on the passing of Congressman Lewis. And I think there was nobody quite understood the instinct there to brush that question off.
You've covered the governor and his communications. Do you think he was caught flat-footed for the question?
It sure looked like it. I honestly, I don't know how else to describe what happened there. It seemed like sort of a political layup, and he missed.
Let's go to Lee in Ocala. He's on the line. Hi, Lee. You're on the Florida Roundup. Go ahead.
Hi there. One of the things that I wanted to comment on was that the progression of this, which I followed for about the last week, maybe 10 days, was that the sheriff, Jacksonville sheriff, announced that originally he was promised a $50 million grant to provide the security for this event, and which required him to hire 2,000 outside officers. I don't know if that meant just sheriffs or sheriffs mm-hmm. and other police officers throughout the state, but anyway, 2,000 other men to do it. That grant was then arbitrarily later cut back after they started sort of planning it to $33 million, and they said, well, that's not enough. And then the White House or Trump or whoever it was that would be issuing the grant said they would not give them any money up front. And, of course, Trump has stiffed every other town he's ever been in for the rallies and never pay a dime to them. So the sheriff said no. And he
That's right, Lee. Yeah. Yeah, you're right, Lee. You've been following it very closely. Obviously, you are absolutely right. That was a big part of why the Jacksonville sheriff put the kibosh on all of this, Matt Dixon. Lee is right. The funding of security was a huge, huge problem. And the funds were not going to be there the way they needed to be, is what we've learned.
Yeah, I mean, without question, I mean, the public health stuff, I think, at least nationally or statewide, the public health stuff has gotten the biggest attention is cases spike and the situation deteriorates. But without question, the sheriff there, his comments were felt. They were heard. And that was, you know, it was really a twofold issue, the public health stuff and then the safety issue.
Lots of tweets coming into the Florida Roundup. Here's one. DeSantis disregarded the danger of the pandemic and has made the state suffer for it. Surges in new cases happening when you parrot Trump and anti-intellectual rhetoric. That's what you've been writing about, Matt. The governor has tied his political fate to the president, and that can cut both ways.
Yeah, one of sort of the great ironies of the situation here is Florida has followed the Trump blueprint, the White House Coronavirus Task Force. The Governor DeSantis has followed that very closely. That path, that strategy has led to the situation we're in. So it's kind of this odd circle where the Trump strategy has made it so Florida can't hold the RNC where Trump wants to have it. And it's a weird circle. But without question, the governor and the president have been linked both politically and policy-wise.
As well as their fates as it comes to 2020 for the president and 2022 for Governor DeSantis, Matt.
Yeah, I think that's totally right. I mean, all focus right now is on 2020. But in a hypothetical world, if the president were to lose Florida and he could, you know, turn on the governor, he could blame DeSantis for losing Florida. That would very, very, very much impact Governor DeSantis's own reelection bid.
Because he ran as that further right candidate in 2018, garnering the support of then President Trump and helping win the Republican primary for the governor's office. Matt, we got to leave it there, but thanks for talking politics with us. Hope you're safe.
All right. You too, guys. Thank you.
Thank you. Matt Dixon covers state politics for Politico Florida. We're going to talk about schools. How's that look in your neighborhood? Are you ready for at-home learning? Do you want to go back to the schoolhouse if you're a parent or a teacher or a staff member, faculty member, janitor, bus driver, or a student? 305-995-1800. As the Florida Roundup continues after this.
Welcome back to the Florida Roundup. Thanks for being with us this Friday. I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville.
I'm Tom Hudson in Miami. Palm Beach County, Hillsborough County, Lee County, St. John's County, Duval County. The first day of school in these districts will be later than originally planned. Schools across the state are scrambling to come up with their reopening plans while dealing with the surging cases of COVID-19 and hospitals filling up. So how should schools in your neighborhood reopen? Do you believe that this is a local decision? 305-995-1800, talking about schools and the coronavirus, rather 305-995-1800 at Florida Roundup. You can follow along on Twitter.
Now, on Wednesday, Governor DeSantis gave a clear green light for school districts in Florida to postpone opening day.
If a school district needs to delay the school year for a few weeks so that everything will be in good shape, have at it. The important thing is that our parents have a meaningful choice when it comes to in-person education.
Now, here's the thing. There's been plenty of confusion over what the state is requiring of schools, whether or not school buildings have to actually reopen to start the year. Earlier this month, Education Commissioner Richard Corcoran issued his own executive order requiring schools to reopen buildings, brick-and-mortar buildings, 5 days a week, unless local health officials advise against that. Here's Corcoran a few days after he issued that order.
Being in front of a great classroom teacher in that room with the interaction between the peers is absolutely the best learning environment for a student. So we want to maximize that to as much to the extent possible, given the circumstances.
But on Monday of this week, the governor distanced himself from his own education commissioner.
I didn't give any executive order. That was the Department of Education. You know, they have a board and they do different things.
Choice has been the word used by the governor and his administration to describe their school reopening desires. The choice for parents to decide whether to send their kids into school buildings or have access to online learning. Republican Senator Rick Scott told Fox Business this week that the choice told Fox Business what the choice is for his grandchildren.
My daughters are going to be more focused on, you know, distance learning right now to make sure their children are safe. But I know other parents are going to want to make sure their kids are back in the classroom.
Ana Ceballos of News Service of Florida has been covering back to school plans around the state and joins us now. Ana, how about all this confusion? Richard Corcoran demanded schools be open 5 days a week. The governor is inching away from that edict. School districts are scrambling to get solutions in place. Why this mixed messaging, do you think, from Tallahassee on our schools?
Well, I think it's important to timing was a big part of the context that as to why the messaging has changed over time. When the executive or the emergency order was first issued July 6th by the education commissioner, President Donald Trump had been pushing on social media, and he even had a roundtable discussion saying that schools must reopen in the fall. So there was a lot of pressure coming from the White House on reopening. And, you know, in Florida, the Governor Ron DeSantis is a very close ally of the president. So it was kind of seemed like a pretty clear messaging coming from Republicans as to the need to reopen schools and give parents the option to come in. But there was a lot of pushback immediately after that order was issued. So it just seems that the state is now explaining a little bit more as to what local school districts should be doing and how they should have the authority to consider what is best for their local conditions and for parents and teachers who don't feel comfortable coming back, that they should have a little bit of a more flexibility as to whether they should want to come back or not.
Let us know how you feel about your school district's reopening plans. Call us up now statewide, 305-995-1800, here on the Florida Roundup. Okay, so amidst all this, Ana, the Florida Education Association, the teachers union, sued the governor and the education commissioner for what they are calling the reckless and unsafe opening of schools. Teachers around the state say they're afraid to go back into the classroom. They don't want to contract COVID. You've been following this lawsuit as well. That added a new wrinkle.
It did. And, you know, it was interesting because it came out, they filed a lawsuit on Monday, and this was at the peak of all the confusion with the order. And since the order was issued on July 6th, the teachers union had been pretty critical, citing, you know, concerns with a lot of their members, saying that there's a lot of vulnerable teachers who were terrified of going back to school. A lot of them were considering maybe taking a sabbatical or not, or changing profession because they just did not feel comfortable. So this, the lawsuit came, you know, as all these concerns and confusion was boiling. And, you know, it's now, you know, we haven't had a hearing yet, but it did kind of set the tone as to why the governor, 2 days later after the lawsuit was filed, was a much softer message as to, you know, yes, I want children to have the option to return to the classroom, but please, if you don't feel comfortable, you don't really have to come back and talk to your local school district. So there was a different, the lawsuit did prompt a softer tone in messaging about the school reopenings at the state level.
We're hearing from parents now here on the Florida Roundup. It's 305-995-1800. Alex is in Homestead. Hey, Alex, worried about sending your children back?
Yeah, I'm really worried. I have two girls. My oldest, she's 13. She did the at-home learning the end of last year, and it was fine. She's ADHD, so I almost think it's better. But for my youngest, she's 5 years old. She's about to start kindergarten. And I'm real concerned that she's not going to have that in-school experience, you know, no first day of school, none of that. And my big thing is, I feel if we would have kept the state locked down until the end of this month when all these benefits run out, we might have been able to have the kids back in school.
Alex, thanks. So, you know, Anna, certainly the governor has taken some criticism for, critics said, shutting the state down too late and then opening it back up too early. What about the perspective from some parents out there that, because of the way this has been handled in Florida, they are now being forced to make these very difficult choices for their kids?
Yeah, I've definitely been hearing that from parents. I was talking to one mom in Volusia County who, you know, she has three children, and the middle one is has asthma, and the older one, he's, you know, in high school, and then the younger one was, you know, also really looking forward to coming to school. So she has, you know, like, she doesn't want to deprive two of her children from experiencing the in-person classes, but she's concerned about the middle one. And she kept saying, you know, like, I just don't know. Like, I mean, I keep seeing the community and everyone is, you know, maybe like if we would have taken this a little bit seriously before, my children wouldn't have to go through this right now and this confusion about, you know, what it will be the best thing. I don't want to deprive them from their band and from their in-person classes and the benefits that in-person instruction offers them. But they just don't feel safe, and they just don't feel like they can put at risk the conditions of the middle child, because, you know, it's just a family decision at this point. It's not about one child or the other.
Anna, we received this tweet from Rachel, who sent the note to @FloridaRoundup. Some children can't remain at home. Unhealthy home lives, abuse, or learning disabilities makes it impossible to learn at home. We need to have some kind of option for them, but everyone who can learn from home should. The governor's talked a little bit about the kind of social role that schools play, not just the educational role, but the social role that schools play in all of the districts in Florida, some of the wraparound services. We've seen school districts continue to do food offerings even during the summertime to make sure that students in their households can have access to warm meals during the pandemic, even during skyrocketing unemployment. What role is the social services component of education playing in the guidance that the state is requesting, and how it will assess the plans coming in from the district?
Right. I mean, the social impact is huge, right? I mean, we know that when there's abuse at a home, their schools are, you know, the main eyes. They see these kids every day. So if a child is acting weird or has a bruise or anything, school employees and teachers will always be, you know, like a pretty big safeguard for preventing or addressing abuse problems. There's also, like you said, you know, that the lunch programs. There's so many kids in Florida. I mean, we have 2.8 million students across the state, and so many of them rely on schools to eat. Mm-hmm. And we also have low-income students who don't have internet access at home. We know in the panhandle in Florida, there's one district, Jackson County, where, you know, a vast majority of children just do not have internet access. Like they just don't have that. So the social component, you know, it's pretty crucial. And the governor has been emphasizing, you know, that sometimes keeping, he said verbatim that keeping schools closed would be bigger, an enormous setback for children than the risk that the virus poses to them, like from a health perspective.
Right. And certainly kids have suffered mentally and emotionally from home learning in some respects. This is such a complicated issue. As we talk with Anna Ceballos of News Service of Florida, Celeste tweets the show, "I'm disappointed with the opening of the schools. I understand learning is essential, but the virus is still powerful. We need to protect teachers, students, admins, and parents." One more tweet for you. "I feel like safely getting the schools open was an afterthought by the state. We need to get the spread down first, not treat kids as lab rats in an experiment." It's 305-995-1800 to call in. Michelle is in Pembroke Pines. Michelle, you're a teacher, is that right?
Hi, how are you? Yeah, I've been a teacher for 25 years in Miami-Dade County Public Schools, and I would love to go back to school. I can't wait, and I can't wait to see my students. I haven't seen them since March. And I think it's wonderful, but the problem is, and what I always hear these great messages, okay, we got to get kids back in school, and whatever the age is, from, you know, 5 to, let's just say, 18. Problem is, I know a lot of teachers such as myself. I'm 57, so I'm not a robot, because most teachers might not be 10 to 15 or 18, so they might get sicker. And I have a family member who got it. Thank God nothing happened to her. She didn't have to go to the hospital, but she couldn't get a negative test for 15 days. No, I'm sorry, 3 weeks, because she couldn't go back with her family for 3 weeks. So if that happened to just an ordinary teacher who was not teaching, thank goodness, what happens if I'm out for 3 weeks? The subs I've seen are between 60 to 80 years old. They're usually retired persons. Now, there's other people that are subbing. So my concern is, if I am out and I'm quarantined or whatever, because someone in my class gets sick, how are you going to run a school system if people are in and out just because they got sick or they contracted the illness? So I feel that we're not taking that into consideration, because we are humans. We're not robots, and we're not 10 to 15 years of age.
And I am thinking of you and all the teachers going back into the classroom. Thank you so much for those thoughts here on the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio. Anna, there are so many contingencies like that that we need to be thinking about once the school year begins. People worried that we could open up schools only to shut them down again if the cases spiral out of control. What are you hearing from education officials about some of these contingencies that we could see?
Right. And I mean, I guess one example would be, how are we doing right now, right? The concern about reopening schools in August is the surge of cases, but right now there's summer school, there's summer camps that are open while, you know, this whole debate is going on. And we've seen some summer camps shut down because 3 kids tested positive or a counselor tested positive. We saw in Miami-Dade that they closed them, all the summer camps, because, again, there was just too much of a concern. And cases were popping up in certain facilities. And so that's, you know, it's a question that many have, because the state order didn't really quite say, if this happens, you have to do this. You know, it kind of leaves the decisions up to the local school district. So it's up to every single one of the 67 school districts to determine exactly how they're going to be handling these situations.
Anna, the decision constitutionally in Florida is at the local school board level. We've heard that almost as a footnote to the comments from the governor's office and from the education commissioner. But I'm curious as to the pressure that they are feeling. You referenced it a little bit earlier in early July from the Trump administration. The U.S. Department of Education Deputy Secretary Brian Montgomery issued a warning just this week to public schools in a call with state and local officials. The Center for Public Integrity published this audio. Take a listen.
Too many government schools already failed their students this past spring. That can't happen again this fall.
Too many government schools already failed their students this past spring, is what he said. That can't happen this fall. How is that resonating in the governor's administration?
Well, I mean, I'm sorry, I didn't quite hear. It was kind of blurry. He said that too many what?
Too many
said too many
schools.
Government schools failed their students. Interesting choice of words, too,
right.
You know, government schools rather than public schools. But he said that that can't happen again this fall.
Right. So basically reopening and then immediately having to reclose or shut down all schools. Well, I mean, right now, the point that the governor is stressing, you know, is we need to reopen, make sure if you have, like you played earlier today, you know, if you have to delay the start of school, have at it, you know, like, and we're seeing everyone's doing that. And I hear from parents as well, you know, like if they have to do it, that's fine, because what they don't want is that they make the decision to send their kids to in-person instruction. The kid has the mentality of sending or of studying in school for the rest of the fall, only to be sent back home. And there's more instability for the school year or for the academics or whatever classes they were taking or extracurricular activities. So there is a concern, you know, that if we do not do this right the first time, that there's going to be more of a disruption for public school students, because you can't just like be sending them back and forth. You want the kid to have a stable learning environment throughout, even if, you know, and you have to have all the measures in place.
And certainly that's what all of us parents want. That's what the teachers want. It's really been insightful to hear from teachers and parents around the state. And thank you, Anna. Anna Ceballos of News Service of Florida, for your insights into this ongoing situation in the state. Thanks for being on the show.
Of course. Thank you.
In a moment, how the state's nursing homes are dealing with COVID. This is the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to the Florida Roundup here on Florida Public Radio. I'm Tom Hudson in Miami.
And I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville. Well, more than a dozen nursing homes in Florida are taking in COVID-19 patients. Now, these are isolation centers where nursing home patients can go and be cared for in special COVID wards. Now, they go to these places after they've been released from the hospital where they were treated for the virus. The state closed down visitations to nursing homes right when the pandemic began back in March. We need to remind everyone, almost half of the deaths from the virus in Florida have been residents and staff at long-term care facilities. And the number of staff members testing positive for COVID has nearly tripled in the past month. So, Florida, do you have a loved one in a nursing home? Maybe you work in a long-term care facility. Give us a call, 305-995-1800. Tweet us, at Florida Roundup.
Danielle Cohen's grandfather lives in one of these centers in Tamarack in South Florida as a full-time resident. His faculty started accepting COVID-positive patients this week.
You know, the wonderful caregivers there have done such a fabulous job of, you know, not having any kind of widespread of the virus, that now they were willingly bringing it in to the building.
His daughter has been anxiously staying updated from her home in Atlanta to her 98-year-old grandfather here in the Sunshine State. Veronica Zaragovia is a healthcare reporter at WLRN. She joins us via FaceTime audio. Veronica, how is Danielle's grandfather getting along?
Well, Tom, today, fortunately, he's stable, but Danielle told me that about a couple nights ago, he had to go into the ER because he had low oxygen levels and had nausea and fatigue. And so right now he's stable, but they know that this changes by the day.
He is a full-time resident to this facility. He wasn't brought there because he was hospitalized for COVID, but he wound up testing positive. Is that correct?
Right. He tested positive about a day after they officially opened their unit. And the thing is that this facility in Tamarack opened up a part of their building for these COVID positive patients that would be coming either outside from hospitals about up to 2 hours away or from within their own nursing facility. So he's now in that isolation unit because he tested positive.
Describe the purpose of these isolation centers.
The primary purpose is to free up beds at hospitals, since as we know that hospitals are experiencing a surge in COVID positive patients. So this is one way to open up beds and free up staff at hospitals. And these are nursing homes or other kind of long-term care facilities that say they have the capacity and the bed space to take in new patients.
And so what do we know about the types of facilities that are participating? Do they volunteer for this role?
Yes, exactly. It's not mandated upon them, and they do volunteer. And then there is I reached out to the Florida Healthcare Association that represents a lot of these facilities in the state, and they've told me that there is a process in which these facilities are vetted. They do keep in mind that this will mean more protective equipment, more staff, more expenses, so they don't take the decision lightly.
I'll tackle the financial question in a moment. Well, what about the staff? Does the current staff of these nursing homes, long-term care facilities, do they wind up caring for these previously COVID positive patients that are coming back from the hospital?
Well, some of the staff are members who have been there all this time, but Governor DeSantis did mention in a press conference this week that he's been deploying staff members to these long-term care facilities to help. So some of them are new staff members that are coming in. A lot of these staff members who've been there for a while, I hear from a lot of them that they earn less than $12 an hour. So a lot of them work in many facilities at once, and this is a problem.
And as we talk about this, we need to point out COVID cases in long-term care facilities are skyrocketing in Florida right now. Let's go to Lucretia. She's on the line. Her brother works in a long-term care facility, and her mother lives in one. Is that right, Lucretia? So you have two relatives in this world.
Yes. One working and one living there. And it's concerning for both. My mom currently has been tested, and she is negative, thank God. But now she has to just sit in her room. I don't think the public really realizes what happens to these people. They're being cared for wonderfully, but socially isolated now. She's in one little room with her, you know, her chair, her bed, and her TV. In fact, I am outside the facility right now because I can walk to her window. And with the window closed, I can call her telephone to talk to her. So I'm going to see
her. Oh, my goodness. So you're outside the facility right now so you can walk up to her window?
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
This is my way of staying in contact with her.
Oh, Lucretia, I can just see it. And I want to thank you for calling because so many families are doing the same, and I know how tough it is. Thank you so much for that call, Lucretia. You know, this is what we're hearing from so many people, Veronica, who have a loved one in a long-term care facility. Even if they're not sick, the isolation is so difficult, and the inability of loved ones to just go inside and hug them and sit with them and be with them.
Oh, absolutely. Danielle Cohen herself has told me her parents haven't seen her grandfather since March. And of course, that's a measure that makes sense to not spread the coronavirus, but it is very difficult for people to not see their loved ones or not be able to see what is going on. You can be told that protection is in place, but if you can't see it, it's a little stressful. It's rather stressful.
Talking about the state of COVID-19 in Florida's long-term care facilities, nursing homes, assisted living facilities, 305-995-1800. To join our conversation, you are listening to the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio. Julie in Miami Gardens. Go ahead. You're on the radio, Julie. Julie, you with us? Julie's listening to the radio. I'll let the radio delay catch up to you, Julie, in Miami Gardens. You have a relative who's been moved to one of these isolation facilities. Go, Julie, are you with us here? Let me try to click on. Go ahead, Julie. We're having a little bit of trouble.
Yep, Perils Alive Radio.
Yeah. Veronica, tell us, though. Julie was going to tell us a story, looks like, about a relative who has moved to a facility without notice. What kind of notifications are required, if any, for patients that are already in these facilities, like Daniel Cohen's grandfather, or for patients who get moved into them.
You know, in their particular case, they found out about a week before this unit opened. So it wasn't enough time to move a relative if that was a concern. In terms of them getting alerted that that a loved one has tested positive, I imagine that happens pretty quickly. But, I mean, this is just something that changes very quickly. And so, I don't know how much, you know, how quickly they're informed exactly, but,
One of the issues is also testing, right? The state has talked about its plan to test nursing home staff every 2 weeks. The Centers for Medicare has some rules that will be coming into play that will require weekly testing soon. What is the status?
Yeah, that is supposedly already happening, the testing every 2 weeks. We've heard about that from Governor DeSantis at press conferences. And but I have heard from experts who say, well, the 2 week gap leaves a little too much time in between testing for somebody, let's say, who's asymptomatic.
I want to jump in and say, Catherine in Miami, an administrator at a home, is on the line. Catherine, we're almost out of time, but go ahead. You're on the air.
Well, I'm an assistant administrator in a assisted living facility, and I think it's important for people to understand that we're very different than nursing homes. People live in ALF because it's a social model and not a medical model. So they are, you know, not accustomed to the kinds of medical equipment that now we're expected to use, the full level of PPE. And that in and of itself can be very isolating. But I would also say that we've been COVID negative this whole time. And I think that has a lot to do with our size. So many of these facilities are huge, and they have staff that work at multiple facilities, particularly in nursing homes. But in a smaller size ALF, we have 32 residents. We can
manage it better. Yeah. Okay, Catherine,
better.
I want to thank you for that. Veronica, in the short time we have left, it's fascinating to get this feedback, but it shows you the complexity of the challenge these facilities are facing.
Yes, absolutely. You know, and I have been trying to reach out to them to understand, but I do know that it's a decision. Yes, it takes they get a little more reimbursement money for each patient, which might help with the costs incurred. But this is a very challenging situation that's unfolding by the day. So the federal government has said that they will be sending strike teams to states that have a high percentage of case rates, and that includes Florida. So there will also be people coming in at the federal level as well.
Yeah, and those strike teams are focused on infection control inside these facilities. Veronica, thanks for sharing your reporting with us.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Veronica Zaragovia covers healthcare for member station WLRN in Miami. Melissa, the story of the listener outside the window.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I keep thinking about. And you just know that that is being repeated across the state and really across this country. And
we've had a number of callers that we couldn't get to, including one who wanted to talk about, teaching her loved one to use Zoom inside a facility so that they could communicate. We've heard stories about FaceTime or, you know, Google Hangout, all these other kind of technologies to try to
get face-to-face
interaction.
You can even be an old-fashioned pen pal now to someone in an assisted living facility. If you get the opportunity to do that, do it, because they're isolated. And thank you for connecting the state by listening with us. This is the Florida Roundup. WJCT Public Media in Jax, WLRN Public Miami produced the show along with Alex Gonzalez and Heather Schatz.
Jason Zapke is the WLRN Director of Radio Programming. Our Radio Operations Director in Miami is Peter Merritt, also our Technical Director. Engineering help from Doug Peterson, Charles Michaels, and Josh Torres. Theme music by Miami jazz guitarist Aaron Libos at AaronLibos.com. I'm Tom Hudson.
And I'm Melissa Ross. Have a great weekend. We'll connect with you next Friday at noon.